Good morning, and the conversation begins here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. Turn on the news, and you'll find all kinds of information about the economy, the economic impact of things, and where we're going. I don't know about you, but I find it very confusing, and it gives me a headache. Well, hopefully we're going to demystify some of that stuff when we come back in just a bit, when we talk with author Steve Landisberg, author of Can You Outsmart an Economist? I know I can't. Can you? All this and more coming up here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. More in just a bit. And we're back. It's Conversation. It's 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. And I'm pleased to welcome here academic, author, economist, Steve Landisberg. His new book, Can You Outsmart an Economist? 100 Plus Puzzles to Train Your Brain. Good morning, Steve Landisberg.
Good morning.
Okay. Economics confuses a lot of people. I will confess I took economics in college, and I barely made it out with my life. Why is it so hard?
Why is it so hard? I'm not sure I have an answer to that other than maybe you had the wrong teacher. Economics is about looking a little bit beyond the obvious when we look at people's behavior in the world, and not just in financial markets and in business, but in the way people interact with each other, when the decisions people make when they're facing incentives, when they're facing trade-offs, the decisions people make when they're deciding who to marry, how many children to have, whether to get a divorce, decisions we make in our businesses, in our personal lives, in the voting booth. It's about looking at the incentives that people face and trying to understand those incentives, trying to understand the problems they're trying to solve, and using that to help predict or understand the way they're behaving. Is it hard to understand other people's behavior? Well, sometimes it's hard. Sometimes there are a few techniques we have that make it a lot easier, and the purpose of this book is to help make it easier, and hopefully also to help make it more fun along the way. I've presented it in the form of 100 and some brain teasers and puzzles, where using a few simple ideas from economics, we can look a little more deeply at the way people are behaving and try to understand it. And again, whether it's easy or whether it's hard depends on how you look at it. But I hope that I've made it easier, and I hope I've made it fun also.
Now, when you teach graduates or undergraduates?
I teach mostly undergraduates, and it's been a real experience. I learn a lot from them. A number of the puzzles in this book are puzzles I've presented to my students over the years, and they've been greatly improved because I've learned from the students which ones are helpful and which ones are not helpful. I've learned from the students which ones they enjoy and which ones they don't enjoy. But more than that, I've learned in some cases from my students what the right answers are, because there are puzzles here that I've assigned to my students. I thought I knew the right answer, and then some student perked up with an answer I had never thought of that was better than mine. And so readers will benefit from all those students I've taught who have shown me better ways to think about some of these things.
Now, that's interesting to me, answers you hadn't thought about. Does that mean economics doesn't offer us one true answer or just a multiplicity of answers?
It offers us, among other things, it offers us a way to weed out a lot of wrong answers. We don't always know exactly what the right answer is for something. And I say this in the book. There are 100 and some puzzles here. And often I give the answers, and often I say, you know, here's what I think the answer is. I'm not entirely sure. It might be some other thing. And I talk about what other possible answers are. I explain why I think I know what the right one is and why I'm not sure. But the main thing we can do is eliminate a lot of wrong answers that sound right on the surface. Would you like me to give you an example of something like that?
Please.
Let's stick with college teaching, since you brought that up. There's a lot of evidence that physically beautiful teachers get much better evaluations from their students. You know, at the end of each semester, my students fill out these forms where they say how they liked me, and every college professor faces that. And there's a great deal of evidence that college professors who are perceived as physically beautiful get better evaluations than their colleagues do. And the puzzle is, how do you explain this? And the obvious answer is that students are a little bit shallow, and like other people, they are swayed by irrelevant things like physical beauty, and they care about that at some level more than they care about the quality of teaching. There's the obvious answer. But the obvious answer is wrong, and if you look a little bit more deeply at incentives, you'll see why it's wrong. The fact of the matter is that beautiful teachers probably are better teachers. And the reason for that is that beautiful people have a lot of job opportunities that other people don't have, not just in things like acting and modeling, but in retail sales, anything where you need to deal with the public. There is an advantage to being good-looking. So on average, a good-looking college teacher is somebody who gave up a lot of opportunities to become a college teacher. And on average, those are going to be people who are very enthusiastic about teaching. And if they're very enthusiastic, on average, they're going to be better teachers. By contrast, the more ordinary-looking teachers, maybe including myself, gave up fewer great opportunities to become teachers, and on average there are going to be exceptions in all directions, but on average they gave up fewer alternative opportunities, on average they're going to be less enthusiastic about teaching, and on average they're not going to be as good at teaching. As I say in the book, if you show me a lighthouse keeper with movie star good looks, I will show you the world's best lighthouse keeper, because anybody who gave up a career in Hollywood in order to keep a lighthouse is probably somebody who really, really cares about doing a good job keeping a lighthouse. It's not a perfect predictor, but it's a good enough predictor that it explains the statistics. It explains what we're seeing in the data on those evaluation forms. So that's sort of a perfect example of the kind of reasoning I highlight in the book.
I think you just hit on the fact of why I barely made it out with my life in economics. He never approached any of the things with practical answers and practical ways to use economics. I mean, you talk about the gross national product, but what does that have to do with my life? It sounds like you make it relevant.
Well, I've tried to, and again, you know, I can give you example after example if you'd like more, or Shall I give you another, or would you like to move
okay.
on to something else?
One more.
Okay, one more. There are a lot of cultures around the world where there's no question about the fact that parents prefer sons to daughters. We've got a lot of data on this, all sorts of evidence, that in many, many places around the world, there's a strong preference for sons over daughters. Question. At the adoption agencies in those countries and in those places, would you expect most prospective parents to be asking for boys or to be asking for girls? Now, the obvious answer is, of course, they'll be asking for boys because that's what almost everybody prefers. It's the obvious answer. It's also the wrong answer. And in fact, what you should expect is to see people asking for girls, and what we do see is people asking for girls. You'll see the reason for that, again, if you look just one step deeper at the incentives people are facing. In a country where people really, really prefer boys, they are very reluctant to give up a boy for adoption. They will give up a boy for adoption only if, and again, there are, of course, exceptions in all directions, but on average, they'll give up a boy for adoption only if there's something really wrong with that boy, a health problem, a behavioral problem, something like that. On the other hand, sometimes people will give up a girl for adoption just because she's a girl in a place where people don't want girls. They'll give up girls for adoption just because she's a girl, even though she's healthy, even though she's well-behaved. And so if you go to the adoption agencies, what you see on average is a lot of perfectly healthy, well-behaved girls and a lot of not so healthy, not so well-behaved boys. If you live in a place like that and if you're looking to adopt a child, you've thought about this. And when you go to the adoption agency, even if you personally prefer boys, just like all your neighbors do, you know that at the adoption agency, the boys are not the boys you want, and the girls are a lot better, and so you will choose to take a girl even if you prefer boys. Again, that's what you predict if you think hard about the incentives that people are facing and the information that they have. It's what you predict and it's what you observe. And that's, again, a perfect example of the way economics teaches us to think and the kind of reasoning that I'm asking people to employ as they work through the puzzles in this book.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Steven Landesberg, economist, author, academic. His new book, Can You Outsmart an Economist? 100+ Puzzles to Train Your Brain. And we have a caller this morning who's already struck. We've already struck a nerve with him. Let's say good morning to Eric. Eric, your question or comment, please.
Oh, yeah. I have a question. How you doing, Mr. Landesberg?
Fine, thank you.
Okay. I was listening to your strategy. I listen to economists like every 2 months. He comes on YouTube. His name is Richard Wolff. He's a Marxist. And he was talking about how this economy that we live in is in serious trouble. And let me give you his views, okay? His views come from, he's a Marxist, a Karl Marx figure. And his theory, and I've seen him on a couple of TV shows, but now he has his own YouTube views where he has over a billion people that watch it. And he talks about how both political parties, how they play this game that they blame each other. But here's the problem. Wall Street, if you remember in 2007, 2008, okay, if you remember the film The Wolf of Wall Street, that was based on a real-life guy who actually did that. It was based on the financial institutions in this country. And if you remember back in the 60s and the 70s, okay, we used to make a lot of stuff here in the United States. Now today we make nothing. Everything's being shipped overseas to China because of the trade deal that Bill Clinton and George Bush had, which was not the free trade agreement, which shipped millions of jobs overseas. So now he talks about income inequality and how that plays a major effect and how the 1%ers, how they make $1 billion. They can make like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and this guy, Jeff Bezos, that runs Amazon. How they make all this money, right, and how they avoid paying taxes. But here's the thing, okay, that working class people that's below is being paid for, okay, they being hit off. So in other words, we don't have no effect to what's going on, to what's happening in the economy. And his whole view is this, okay, that in the economy there's a 7-year cycle. He goes back to 1929, the last great president that he says that we had was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and had presidents that came up before that had that effect. Now, my question is to you, what are your views on income inequality right now that we're dealing with in this country and how that's affecting everybody? Hello?
Okay, that was a lot of material. We went from trade agreements to inequality to a lot of other issues. But you asked about inequality. You know, there's some... There are some puzzles in the book and some data in the book that lead people through seeing how the data on things like inequality can be very misleading if you take it at face value. Some puzzles where I present data that real world data that again is telling a very different story than you might think it's telling. For example, over a recent 20-year period in American history. In fact, I'm trying to pull the numbers up in front of me right here as we speak. I don't have the exact numbers. They are in the book, Can You Outsmart an Economist? In a recent period in American history, median incomes, again, I wish I had the numbers in front of me, and I think I will in a second here. Median income for all workers, 1980 to 2005, 25 years, median income for all workers went up by about 3%. Now, that sounds like a terrible improvement. Over 25 years, we expect people to things to get much better than that. 3% growth over 25 years for the median American worker, it sounds like almost no improvement at all. You break that down, though, into different groups. And you look at the white male Americans, white male Americans' income increased by 15%. And so the question is, does this mean that on average, white males did better than other groups? Average median income for all groups up 3%, median income for white males up 15%. Can we conclude from that white males were the big winners here? Answer, no. In fact, non-white males, their incomes went up 16%. White females, up 75%. Non-white females, up 62%. Every group, white males, in fact, did the least well of the bunch. Every group had their incomes going up spectacularly. So how can it be that overall incomes go up only by 3%? And the answer is that demographics changed, that the number of white males in the economy shrank, the number of non-white females in the working force went way up. It's as if, and I use this example in the book, you're a farmer, you got a bunch of goats and a bunch of cows, and your average goat weighs 100 pounds, your average cow weighs 1,000 pounds, you get a whole bunch more goats, then your average animal's weight is going to go way down regardless of what's happening to the weights of the individual animals. If you've got a bunch of 100-pound goats and a bunch of 1,000-pound cows, they can all be growing like crazy, but if the goat population keeps increasing, the average weight is going to keep coming down. If you've got groups that have lower incomes, and if those groups keep increasing, and if other groups with high incomes keep shrinking, the average income is going to come down, and it's going to come down even if each individual's income keeps going up. So numbers on things like this can be very, very misleading. And again, there are a number of examples in Can You Outsmart an Economist where you can see that you don't want to just look at these numbers on the surface. You want to dig a little bit more deeply into them.
Did that help, Steve? I mean, did that help, sir? He's gone. Okay.
Okay.
As you were saying that, though, it occurred to me that that's a great argument for Donald Trump to make.
Well,
in terms of immigration, because he wants.
I'm not sure. I never know what arguments Donald Trump is going to want to make, and I'm never really sure what he's trying to accomplish. But as we bring immigrants into the country, they are on average going to have lower incomes because on average, they're going to be starting from scratch where others are going to have been here for 20 years building businesses and so on. On average, they're going to have lower incomes. That's going to bring down the average income because you're adding to the pool a bunch of people with low incomes. That does not mean that any individual is doing worse. All of our incomes can be going up. We can still see the average come down because we're adding a bunch of immigrants or a bunch of people whose incomes are relatively low. And somebody can look at that and say, look, we admitted all these immigrants and average incomes went down. That can happen even if the immigrants' incomes are going up, even if everybody else's incomes are going up. All of our incomes can be going up like crazy. You're still going to see the average come down because we have a bigger mix of immigrants than we had before. Just looking at that average is going to be terribly misleading. And, politicians, of course, can use misleading data for all sorts of nefarious purposes. But the point of the book and the point I'm hoping to make is that we shouldn't fall for that. We should look a little more deeply at those numbers and figure out what the numbers really mean.
Exactly. And I think the argument you just laid out is the argument Donald Trump would make. Incomes are going down because we're letting all these people in. So stop letting the people in and incomes will go up.
He might very well make that. Again, I'm not in the business of predicting what Donald Trump will say, but I think you might be right. And again, it would be a very, very misleading thing to say. If I make $100,000 a year and a bunch of new people move onto my street who make $20,000 a year, and if my income doubles and their incomes double, at the end of the year, you're going to think that average incomes on my street went down because last year it was just me. Now it's me plus a bunch of other people who make less than I do. But it's the wrong comparison. My income went up. Their income went up. That's what we care about. It's not the average that we care about.
I think you're hitting an important point, and I wonder if you deal with it at all in heck, can you outsmart an economist? And that
quite
is
a bit.
Is that that is people use statistics and economic issues to confuse and flummox people so they don't know what they should think.
Absolutely. There are any number of examples of that. You know, there was a famous case at the University of California at Berkeley several years ago where, again, I'm going to look in the book here and see if I can get the exact numbers for you. If I can't, here we go. Overall, in applications to Berkeley's graduate programs, 46% of men who applied to graduate school at Berkeley were accepted, only 30% of women, even though it was clear overall that the women were just as qualified as the men. Women and men, on average, equally qualified. They're admitting 46% of the men. They're admitting 30% of the women. And the question is, can we infer from this that there's some discrimination going on here? Well, a lot of lawyers thought there was that we could infer there's some discrimination going on here. And in fact, there ended up being a famous lawsuit against Berkeley on those grounds. The lawsuit was thrown out of court pretty quickly when it was discovered that, in fact, each individual department at Berkeley was admitting women at a higher rate than men. Every department was admitting women at a higher rate than men, but the university as a whole was admitting men at a higher rate than women. How do you explain that? Answer, on average, for whatever reason, women were applying to the more selective departments disproportionately. You got a bunch of women applying to the medical school, where the medical school hardly admits anybody. You got a bunch of men applying to the law school, which is very easy to get into. Then, of course, on average, men are going to be more successful than women because men were at that time and place, for whatever reason, they were choosing to apply to the easier departments. The women were choosing to apply to the more selective departments. And so you find at the medical school, they're admitting, and I'm making these numbers up, but it's typical of what was going on. At the medical school, they're admitting 3% of the women, 2% of the men. At the law school, they're admitting 80% of the women, 70% of the men. Women are being accepted at a higher rate in both those places, but it's still true that men mostly are getting in because they're applying to that easy law school. Women are mostly getting rejected because they're applying to that very selective medical school. As soon as the judge saw the actual numbers on this, that case was thrown out of court, not before a lot of lawyers had submitted a lot of bills. But again, the exact numbers, I made some numbers up here for illustration. The exact real-world numbers are in the book. And it's a good example, once again, of why we need to look beyond the obvious. The numbers that you see in front of you are not always the numbers that tell the entire story.
And you're listening to Conversation. My name is Peter Solomon, and you're on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My guest this morning, Steven Landsberg, academic author. His new book, Can You Outsmart an Economist? 100 Plus Puzzles to Train Your Brain. And Steven, we have another caller. Let's say good morning to Brian. Brian from West Philly, your question or comment, please.
Yeah, how you doing, Peter?
Hi.
Mr. Landsberg, I was listening to the last caller, and it kind of woke me up because I've seen the guy who he was speaking about. The question I have for you is this, is that if you agree with that premise that you just said, I don't believe that not one bit. If you look at the income that most people work for per year, okay, the salaries and the wages have moved down. The people at the top are making billions of dollars. When Donald Trump gave that tax cut to the billionaires, and he's talking about this this tax on corporations like China and places like that, and, you know, that's going to damage this country. And let me give you an example. Everything in Walmart and Amazon is being made overseas. So if it's been shipped in, though, from overseas, okay, from China, okay, which is a major factor in the game. China is a big-time factor in the game. okay? In the last 30 or 40 years, China's economy is moving up. Most of the factories that you speak about, because of Bill Clinton and George Bush, like the last caller just explained to you, with this NAFTA free trade agreement, have moved overseas and moved to China. Walmart, McDonald's, all them corporations are in China. You got 1 billion people that's in China, okay? The salaries in China haven't moved in the last 30 or 40 years. But being that China's a communist country, the salaries and wages are starting to move. And they're working for the same hours that we work for. And probably China is now moving to a part-time workforce. Now, here's the problem. In the United States, we don't have 1 billion people. China has 1 billion people, okay? And if you look at it here in the United States, the wages that he was speaking on, maybe he didn't make his point clearly enough, the wages haven't moved for the average workers here in the United States, okay? Unions, they used to be a part of the 1929, like when economic crash that happened in 1929 with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the unions were strong. That's where the unions came out of, okay? Social Security came from the Great Depression. The Federal Jobs Act came from the Great Depression. All that came from the struggle of 1929. What happened was when we had a crash in 2008 and 2009, that happened because of the banks, the financial institutions, and when the bubble burst that was on Wall Street, that had a catastrophic calamity, okay, that happened around the world globally. So what happens is what Mr. Wolf's talking about. There's a 7-year cycle that the economy that we have here in the United States, sometimes the economy is going to be doing good, and then they have their peaks, and they have their valleys. And that's what's been going on. In the last couple of months on Wall Street had the lowest numbers that they had. We never dug out of what happened in 2007, 2008. To make your point, the wages haven't moved, but the rich is benefiting off of it. The rich corporations, if you do some research, Peter, do some research, and I did it myself. Most corporations, okay, don't pay taxes. They got tax havens that's over in Panama, that's in Switzerland, that's over in all those foreign countries. I was a part of the Occupy movement. When Bernie Sanders came up, when Bernie Sanders ran for the election for president, if you listen to everything that Bernie Sanders was saying, him and Elizabeth Warren saying the same thing now, okay, that the rich is getting away with murder. And they have been getting away with murder for the last 10, 20, or 30 years because they have these tax havens that's overseas. Comcast is one of the biggest places here in the United States, okay? Comcast right now, okay, the top shareholders of Comcast are making billions of dollars. But the working class people are struggling. They got to get up every day, they got to work. Every day they got to get up to pay paycheck. And guess what? Your guest never mentioned about the living wage and how the cost of living has risen in the last 20 or 30 years. This is where I disagree with him.
Well, as with the last caller, there's so much here. I'm not sure where to begin. Let's start with talking about the cost of living and tying that back to the discussion about Walmart and China and so on. The cost of living includes things like the cost of shopping at Walmart. And if you go into Walmart, it's amazing how inexpensive things are. I buy a lot of clothes at Walmart, and they're wonderful, and they're unbelievably inexpensive. That's a huge improvement in my cost of living and a bigger improvement for people who make less money than I do. Being able to shop at Walmart and buy a nice shirt for $5 instead of having to go to the mall and pay $25 for a similar shirt, that's a huge improvement in our cost of living. The fact that we trade with other countries where things can be made more cheaply than they can be made in the United States, that's one of the best things that has ever happened to Americans with low income. Foreign trade, and again, there are examples in the book. Foreign trade, the main effect of foreign trade is that we get to buy a lot of things a lot more cheaply than we would buy them if they were made, if we had to make them here in the United States. That's a good thing, and it's a good thing especially for the poorest Americans.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
I want to ask you a question, okay, what you just said. if you listen to my point was that most of the jobs that you have now are low-wage jobs, no benefit jobs, and no security.
Oh, well, that's not true. It is not true that most jobs are low-wage jobs.
No, listen to what I'm saying. Donald Trump sits in the White House and blow his horn about, well, guess what? Well, we created jobs. Well, Obama did the same thing. Okay, it has nothing to do with political parties.
It has nobody said it
It has nothing to do with political association, because these are the same politicians that's in Washington that signed the NAFTA Free Trade Agreement, that signed the Pacific Trade Agreement, okay, that shipped millions of jobs overseas. Now, my whole point was that China is a major force in the economy, because when you're dealing with a billion people, okay, in China, okay, China now, Peter, Mr. Wolf was saying, is going to supersede the United States in the next couple of years. They are on the move. A major move, because what's going on? When you got a billion people that's in the tech industry, okay, that's making billions of dollars, okay, and their wages and their salaries have moved up for China workers. Here in the United States, there have been a decline of that. And let me give you an example. What's your guess, Mr. Lattenberg?
Those Chinese workers are working for you. Those Chinese workers are working for you. They're making your clothes for you.
Listen.
You're a beneficiary of that.
I know somebody who works at Walmart now. Personally, I know him. My son, okay, he would tell you, okay, most of the people that work at Walmart, okay, that were on food stamps and Medicaid, okay.
You know anybody who shops at Walmart?
No.
You know anybody
here's
who shops
point.
At Walmart?
Here's my point. For billionaires, you're talking about Sam Walton, who ran Walmart. His kids are the heirs. They make billions of dollars, okay, runs a worldwide corporation that can't provide health care for their workers. That's insane. That's the most insane thing that I ever heard. Because guess what? They benefit off the top. And guess what, Mr. Lambert? It's going to be a calamity, because you can't have this keep going on. People barely working every day, barely making it. There will be repercussions behind that. Trust me. Because people are starting to wake up and realize, even with this government shutdown, okay, that the politicians in Washington doesn't mean anything. And they're starting to listen to Mr. Wolf, who's been around, and this man got a master's degree, and he went to school with Janet Yellen, who's part of the Federal Reserve. So he knows what he's talking about, okay? He ain't just talking just to be talking. He got like a million people that's on YouTube. He comes out of New York, okay? And he's been asked to come on shows where he had people that disagree with them. But he's been able to prove his point, because his point's been proven out. Because if everything that he said, I've seen. And it's been happening. It's been happening. The salaries haven't moved since 1970. Since the 70s. The wages haven't moved. The workforce used to be men. It's flipped over to women in the last 30 years. Okay? It flipped over to women.
I can't figure out what your caller's question is, so maybe
okay,
we can...
Okay,
yeah, we'll move on.
Okay, here's my question, Mr. Lattenberg. Do you agree or don't you agree that the salaries and the wages have moved in the United States since the 1970s?
Well, that is factually false. That they haven't moved, that's factually false.
Okay, this sounds
Maybe we can move on now.
Yeah, this sounds like a debate we're not going to settle. I want to say thank you, Brian, for calling.
Okay, thank you.
And you're listening to Conversation. We're talking the economy and a whole lot more with economist author Stephen Landsberg, author of Can You Outsmart an Economist? Stephen, though, you did raise an interesting point I want to pick up on, and that is buying the shirt at Walmart for $5 that you might have to spend $25-$30 at the mall, okay? Yes, it's cheaper, and that's a good thing because that increases my buying power. But if the person making the shirt is in China, there's less people with buying power here in America, because that job to making that shirt could have been filled by an American here in America. Am I making sense?
You are, but the fact of the matter is that because the worker in China is making that shirt instead of an American and American making that shirt, it means that Americans are able to, instead of having to have a whole lot of Americans working in the garment industry, a lot of those Americans, there's going to be some retraining involved, there's going to be some readjustment involved, but a lot of those Americans then end up in much better jobs. They end up, instead of sitting in front of a sewing machine all day, sitting in front of a computer, which is a somewhat more pleasant job. The quality of the jobs that Americans have goes up when foreigners take over our least pleasant jobs, when foreigners take over our when foreigners compete away our least pleasant jobs, the jobs people least want to do. Part of the effect of that is that Americans move into other jobs, which in the long run they like a lot better and succeed at a lot better. And the other side of that equation, again, is that American consumers get a huge break in the prices that they're paying. Overall, there's no question of the fact that that's making Americans, almost all Americans, and especially the poorest Americans, richer, better off. Is there some readjustment? Is there some a little bit of pain along the way as we switch from one kind of an economy to another? Sure, if you've been a garment worker your whole life and now you've got to learn to do some other kind of job, that's not going to be the easiest thing in the world. But it is not true that if somebody in China competes your job away that you'll never work again. What is true is you're going to need some retraining. You're going to move into something else. We see that in the data, and there is essentially no economist, and I say this, this is not exaggeration. There is essentially no economist who believes that trade on average has been bad for Americans. Trade on average has been extremely good for Americans. It's the source of most of our prosperity. It's the reason people can afford to live enormously better now than they did 30, 40, 50 years ago. And it's the reason you've got a smartphone in your pocket. It's a reason that same smartphone, if we were not trading with foreigners, would cost, it cost, for $1,000 now, you can get a top-of-the-line smartphone. That same smartphone would cost $150,000 or more if everything had to be done here in the United States. Only the very rich would have them. Nothing has helped poor Americans more than foreign trade has helped poor Americans.
All right.
Hello?
I'm still trying to sort out my own confusion about all this stuff.
Oh, sure.
So how do we improve our own knowledge and our own ability to cope with economics then? Obviously, we get a book like yours and figure out some of the puzzles and understand the thinking. But there's more than one thinking for every puzzle. You even said that, or can be more than one thinking for every
there
puzzle.
There is more than one thinking for every puzzle. And I part of the answer is I having to accept the fact that we don't know all the answers to everything. That's true in economics. It's true in physics. It's true in any other economics, in any other academic subject. We don't know the answers to everything. But there are ways of thinking that are useful, and there are ways of thinking that are not useful. And what I'm trying to show in How Can You Smart an Economist is the difference between the useful ways of thinking and the non-useful ways of thinking. You know, we've had a couple callers who really wanted to, they had a lot to say or thought they had a lot to say, but what they were not doing was just looking carefully piece by piece at each step in their arguments. They were obviously pretty angry about some things, but in terms of actually thinking through, yes, you can point out that Chinese workers earn low wages. You can point out that that's tough for American workers to compete with. But you're only looking at one side of the story there. You got to also look at the fact that every American worker is also an American consumer. And as consumers, we care about not just wages, we care about prices. And again, if everything costs one-fifth as much as it does because of foreign trade, and that's probably a low estimate, that's making a huge difference in the way Americans live. Again, this is something that essentially all economists agree on. They're quoting one guy they found on YouTube who apparently says different, but 99% of economists will tell you that foreign trade is making Americans richer every single day. So part of the answer is don't listen to one random guy on YouTube. Look at the data. Look at the facts. Decide for yourself. be swayed a little bit by the fact that 99% of economists agree on these things, but that's not the main thing. The main thing is you can understand it for yourself. If you look at a few numbers and you look at a few logical arguments, and I like to think that my book shows you how to do that. It shows you how to pick these numbers apart. It shows you how to not be misled by spurious arguments that only look at one side of the equation. To be sure you're looking at both sides, you don't want to ignore either. Ignore either side of the picture. You want to take everything to account at once, and the book shows you some techniques for how to do that.
And you're listening to Conversation. We're talking economics, understanding economics, and a whole lot more with Stephen Landsberg, economist, academic, author. His book, Can You Outsmart an Economist? Stephen, my grandmother had a saying, the rich get rich and the poor get poorer. And that's what it feels like. I mean, we have politicians talking about the death of the middle class. It's a shrinking group. I've seen statistics that say the millionaire group is becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. The billionaire group is getting bigger, bigger, and bigger. Does the book help us understand whether that's true or not?
It is true that income inequality is increasing. I think the book will help you understand what that does and does not mean. For one thing, you see this increase in income inequality, but we don't see it reflected so much in consumption inequality, which is what really matters. If a guy is making 100 times as much as you are, but he's only consuming twice as much as you are, then the burden he's imposing on the planet, the burden he's imposing on future generations, is not 100 times as much. It's twice as much. In fact, if he's making 100 times as much as you, it's probably because he's producing 100 times as much stuff as you. If he's consuming twice as much as you, he's consuming twice as much as you are. He's leaving a lot more for other people than you are. Again, this is a very stylized example here, and you can think about lots of examples that go in other directions. But if you think about the burden that you are imposing on your fellow citizens, it's not your income that is in some sense a burden to them. It's your consumption. Every orange that you eat is an orange that I can't eat. Every ton of coal that you burn is a ton of coal that I can't burn. And it's your consumption that in some sense is the thing we should really be worried about if we're worried about inequality. Inequality in consumption has not moved anything like the way inequality in income has moved. So that's one thing you want to take account of. Other things you want to take account of are that everyone's income has been rising over time. It has been rising less dramatically over the past several years than it was for many decades before that. That's an issue. We want to understand the reasons for that a little better. We don't completely understand the reasons for it, but incomes continue to rise. If you take a broader view of human history, you know, up until a couple of hundred years ago, human beings were around for 100,000 years, and essentially everybody lived right on the verge of starvation, except for a few kings and queens and noblemen, noblewomen. Almost everybody who ever lived for the first 100,000 years of human history was living right about the subsistence level, where any change in their income meant they were going to starve to death. Only a couple hundred years ago did that change, and it has changed dramatically. And it has changed dramatically largely through a combination of technology, science, capitalism, and free trade. Those are the ingredients that have made it possible for the average person to live not just on the verge of starvation, but at a level that would have been unthinkable to our ancestors 300 years ago, with those smartphones in our pockets and those $5 shirts at Walmart. All of that is directly traceable to the growth, and you can't separate these things. They all grew together. Science, technology, capitalism, and free trade, those are the ingredients that have created prosperity for the vast majority of the world.
Okay. Then I have a question. With the recent government shutdown, you saw a lot of people going, oh, my God, I can't afford food. I can't afford medical care. They're going to take my house. More and more people are living paycheck to paycheck. That doesn't sound like a prosperous economy to me.
Well, I agree that incomes are not growing the way they were growing 20, 30 years ago. And that's why they're not is a very interesting question and an important question and a question we need to understand better. But when you talk about these people who are living paycheck to paycheck, I'm going to guess, if we're talking about broad historical terms, none of those people wants to go back to 300 years ago when over half your children were going to die before age 10, when you were going to die before age 50, when you were going to spend over half the days in your life going to bed hungry, really hungry. That is the human condition. That is the human condition that that modern economics has brought us out of. And and it's the condition that you don't have to go back 300 years. If you go back 50 years, some crazy people will tell you that life was much better 50 years ago. It wasn't. You talk about 50 years ago, most of those people, and I sympathize with them, but most of those people who are living paycheck to paycheck today, worried about how they're going to make it through the week, most of those people 50 years ago would have been living much lower quality lives with, again, Walmart not available, the smartphones not available, and medical care, the quality of medical care. You talk about not being able to afford it. Our medical system is terrible. It could be improved dramatically, but it is still so much better than it was 50 years ago. No sane person would want to go back to what it was then. We are making progress. Would it be better to make faster and better progress? Of course it would. Are economists thinking about how we can try and make that happen? Of course we are. But progress is there, and the world is a far better place than it was 50 years ago for everybody, for people at the bottom, for people in the middle, and for people at the top. There's no doubt about that.
It sounds to me like your book ought to be in colleges for the Economics 1 course. I mean, I remember the book we had, I think it was by a guy named Samuelson.
Uh-huh.
Didn't explain any of this stuff, that like you're explaining it and making it real.
Well, Samuelson wrote a good book, and he was a great economist. Just recently died, but he was one of the titans of the 20th century in economics. But I agree, in many ways, his book was it was a little dull, it was a little dry, and I'm trying to keep things a little livelier than perhaps he did.
Who do you want to read your book? Who should read it?
Well, everybody in first of all, I want everybody in the world to read it, and second of all, I want everybody in the world to buy it. But I think the natural audience is people who like to think. People who, this is not a book where I'm presenting a bunch of facts. Facts are interesting, but logic is really the key to what the book is about. It's not just throwing a bunch of facts at you. It's in the context of very simple examples, thinking through how to interpret numbers, thinking through what numbers mean, and thinking about the ways in which we can so easily be misled by numbers, and learning to avoid those misleadings. There are examples in there from sports, examples involving batting averages, where simple analysis of the numbers can so easily lead you astray. There are examples of that throughout. We talked about the case of the discrimination in the Berkeley graduate departments. We talked about the median incomes. Again, many, many more examples from sports and other areas where a little bit of critical thinking will help you avoid some of the simplest mistakes that people make when they analyze the numbers that they have in front of them. Trying to demystify things, trying to say you don't have to pour through pages and pages of numbers and data in order to get a picture of what the economy is about. What you need to do is think. What you need to do is think about what really lies behind these numbers. What are the problems that people are trying to solve? Why are people behaving the way they are? As we saw with the adoption agencies, as we saw with the teacher evaluations, why are things not exactly the way they look on the surface? Looking a little bit beneath the surface to see how we can understand the world better, and above all, to have some fun along the way. So it's a book for people who like to think about puzzles. It's a book for people who like to understand things a little bit better maybe than they did before, But the main thing is that puzzles are fun. I love puzzles. I've been blessed to have a lot of students who love puzzles. It's all about solving puzzles, and it's fun in its own right. I hope it helps you understand the world better, but the main thing is to have some fun.
Amen to that. And it also sounds like, though, with this need for critical thinking, that economics one, excuse me, college, is too late. Maybe we need to start in high school or even elementary school. What do you think?
Well, you know, I'm of mixed feelings about that because I do teach college economics, and my students come to me, and a lot of them had economics in high school. Sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes it turns out to be a bad thing because sometimes they had a teacher in high school who didn't really understand the subject, and they got a lot of misleading ways of thinking along the way that I sort of have to unteach them. So teaching economics in high school is great if it's taught right. It's not so great if it's not taught right. Sometimes it's taught right. Sometimes it's not.
Do you have a website, Stephen?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
you. Do you have a website?
Oh, absolutely. OutsmartAnEconomist.com. All one word. If people go to OutsmartAnEconomist.com, they can read a chapter of the book for free. They can read some reviews. They can see how to order it. But, hey, you can read a chapter for free, and you can decide for yourself if this is the book for you.
And I want to say thank you to Stephen E. Landsberg, academic author, the book, Can You Outsmart an Economist? 100-plus puzzles to train your brain. Thank you, sir.
And once again, OutsmartAnEconomist.com, all one word.
And it's been another edition of Conversation here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. Nothing left to say, but see you soon. Good morning, and the conversation continues here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio as we ease on into WIP Sunday, the last Sunday of the month. My God, where did January get to? But be that as it may, the end of January means the African American Children's Book Project and its fair are coming right around the corner. February 2nd, 2019. At Community College of Philadelphia, 17th and Spring Garden Streets, 1 to 4 p.m. Good parking, good accessible by public transportation. And that's what we're going to start with our WIP Sunday here this morning as I welcome one of the authors who will be coming, Ronald Smith. Good morning, Ronald Smith.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. You have written some incredible books for kids in the middle grades. Black Panther, The Young Prince, and The Mesmerist. How do you choose what you're going to write about?
Well, let's see. I do really like writing for children's literature, for kids. You know, I used to write books for an older audience, but I found that, you know, writing for young people is a great honor. You know, I love reading books about fantasy and adventure and science fiction, and I most enjoyed reading those books when I was a kid, so... You know, several years ago, I was writing stories, literary stories, and one day I said, you know, I should kind of write the stories that I liked to read when I was a kid. And that's what got me kind of reinvigorated again to write children's stories. And it just took off from there, and I'm really glad to be writing these books for such a great age group.
But can you make a living at it? I mean, I can't imagine the royalty checks are that big.
Well, that's an interesting question, you know. Not one that you get often. Sometimes I get that question from kids. Absolutely. You might want to ask a woman named J.K. Rowling.
Okay.
You know, there are lots of great authors that that make money. But, you know, the first thing you should do in life is do something you really enjoy, right? I mean, I worked in advertising for many years as a writer. And I made a living as a writer, which was great. But now I'm proud to say that I can make a living writing children's books. So, if there's anybody out there, I would not dissuade them from writing because they can't make a living from it. They should do it because they really enjoy it.
Because the reason I ask is a lot of people think children's literature is second-class literature because it's for children. Their minds don't go with complicated, but they do, don't they?
Well, you know, we do get that question as well, and there's lots of snarky answers for it, but I won't give you those today. Children's literature is just as rich, varied, and complicated as adult fiction. Kids are smart. They can pick up on somebody that's trying to preach to them or trying to teach them a moral lesson that's too obvious. And, you know, I think today we have a booming market in children's literature that we didn't have before. Years ago, books like Catcher in the Rye, Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, that was just called fiction. Those characters were young, but today we call it children's literature. So what I do is I write serious books with young characters. That's the way I look at it. Children's literature is a very difficult category to break into because everyone thinks they can do it, and they do think that it might not be as, you know, that it's easier than writing quote-unquote serious fiction. But that's not really the case.
And again, if you want an answer to that question, besides talking to Ronald Smith, you can ask J.K. Rowling.
or very many other authors that I know and really like. And you'll see a lot of them next Saturday at the African American Children's Book Fair.
Now, tell me about your latest book, the one that you're going to be highlighting in your visit to the fair.
The latest book comes out next month, February 19th, and it's called The Owls Have Come to Take Us Away. And it's kind of a supernatural science fiction story having to do with a young kid who believes that he's been abducted by aliens. And the thing about it is, do we think, is this really happening, or is this all in his head? So it takes place on Air Force bases, and I grew up on Air Force bases, so I know that subculture very well. But it's really about this kid's journey, about a kid not being accepted, and something that he's obsessed with. So the reader doesn't really know whether this is really all in his head or whether this is something that is really happening. So I'll be talking about that book, as well as Black Panther, The Young Prince. And my first book, Hoodoo, which is a very popular book that I really enjoyed writing, and it kind of launched my career when I wrote it because it won a Coretta Scott King John Steptoe New Talent Author Award, so I was really proud of that. And so I'll be talking about all the books, but that's my latest, is The Owls Have Come to Take Them Away.
All right, I do want to ask about Black Panther, The Young Prince. That has turned into such a phenomenon, the whole Black Panther genre. What led you to decide to jump in?
Well, I was very, very fortunate to get an offer from Marvel Press, which is owned by Disney, to write the book. That's something that I was very fortunate to get the opportunities to do. They approached me. I think they had read some of my previous work. And, you know, that's such a great, and this was right before the film came out, so it was time to coincide with it. And that world is created already. The world of Wakanda is there. The characters are there. The mythology is in place. All I had to do is tell the story of what would it be like for a young T'Challa before he becomes the Black Panther. So my story is about young T'Challa before he becomes the Black Panther. And there's a threat that happens in Wakanda, and he gets sent to Chicago anonymously, living with the secret identity. No one knows who he is. So he goes to a middle school on the south side of Chicago. So what's it like if all of his privilege is stripped away, right? I mean, we know him as Black Panther. He's a king, but before that, he was a prince. So he would be very privileged, right? So what would it be like to strip that all away and get to see the world the way other kids do? So I thought it was a really fun way to write about it.
Was it hard, though, to cope with people's preconceived notions of Wakanda and the Panther?
Well, you know, it's a very rich world that Marvel has already created. It was difficult for me because I really like that character a lot. You know, I read the comic books, and it's like, oh, my God, now I've got to write about this, you know, so it was very intimidating. But once I had the story beats down and the outline, I kind of knew where I was going, and, you know, I shared my synopsis with them there, and they were very cool helping me out with questions and anything that I had questions about. So, yeah, I mean, writing is difficult. You just have to stay in your chair and write every day and, you know, tell a good story. So once I got into it, it wasn't that hard, but I tried not to be overwhelmed by the big nature of it. You know, I just looked at it as a fantastic opportunity and to do the best job I could.
Now, As a writer, I mean, you basically need your imagination and a computer, right? Or do you do longhand?
Well, when I started out many years ago, right, it was writing longhand. But these days, you know, I've got my laptop and I write in coffee shops or here at home. So all you need is that or a pen and imagination and you're ready to go.
All right, then. Why pack up your laptop and come to Philadelphia and to the African-American Children's Book Fair on February 2nd?
Well, it's a wonderful opportunity. I do a lot of school visits and attend a lot of festivals. And I really like giving back to the community and talking to kids. Excuse me. And they're the best audience. You know, they're excited. You know, it's fun to talk to them about reading and what kind of books inspired me as a kid. And hopefully, you know, set them on a path to becoming, if not writers, at least better readers. You know, opening their minds to fiction, nonfiction, history, everything that's out there for them to read. So I think if they can see me and see a successful author, it might help them, you know, make a career path that's in the arts or creative field or whatever it is they're doing, whether it's ballet, music, sports, whatever. You know, I go in and tell them that they can be whatever they want to be if they keep trying. So I really, really think that the book fair is going to be a great opportunity for that.
Why is it important for minority children, children of color, to have books with people who look like them?
Well, every kid should be able to see him or herself in a story, right? You know, when I was growing up reading fantasy books, which I really enjoyed, none of the characters looked like me. And I said, well, that's interesting. I didn't really think of it much as a kid. You know, as I got older, I realized this. So I think that every kid, no matter their background, race, religion, creed, whatever, they need to see themselves in books, you know. They need to see themselves as superheroes or saving the day or doing whatever because it's inspiring, it gives them hope. Representation matters, right? So that's why I like writing for kids and writing about kids of color in my book also.
Obviously, you like getting questions from kids. What's the best question you ever got asked?
Can you make a living as a writer, which you asked me earlier? Also, how much money do you make? Do you live in a mansion? How long does it take to write a book? Kids have no filter, right? So they just go for it. And I try to give good answers, that's the great thing. You know, sometimes they'll really pin you down. They'll say, well, on page 75, you said this. Now, on page 78, you said that. How do you figure? You go, oh, no. You know? So they really will press you on details and really hold your feet to the fire. So it's challenging. It's always fun.
And I want to say thank you to Ronald Smith for coming to the African-American Children's Book Project and the African-American Children's Book Fair on February 2nd, 1 to 4 p.m., Community College in the Gym, 17th and Spring Garden, and for the interview this morning. And you don't have to be African-American to go to the book fair because his book, Black Panther, the Young Prince, excites children of all ages, black, white, yellow, checkered, whatever. Go check him out. Thank you, Ronald Smith.
All right. Thank you.
And you're listening to WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP. We'll be back after these messages. And you're listening to WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. Found one of my guests. And I'm pleased now here to welcome to discuss his new book, Silence in the Age of Noise. And I'm going to apologize now because I'll probably murder his name. His name, as I understand it, is Erling Kagi. Good morning, sir.
Hi, good morning.
Did I murder your name too bad?
I think your Norwegian is improving. It's more like Erling Kagge.
Okay. Well, Erling, cool. Silence. It truly is a noisy world, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it's more noisy today than ever. So you can say, I think it's much more noisy than it was 50 years ago, but it's also much more noisy than it was 3 or 4 years ago.
Why do you think that is?
I think it is because the way we're living, that we are having all these devices, smartphones, pads, etc., they're all available. There's so many temptations in terms of different apps. So we tend to live through our smartphones and kind of running away from ourselves than kind of listening to our own inner silence. And when I look at my kids, I have three teenage daughters. It seems like the more they try to avoid boredom with their phones, the more bored they get.
This is true, I'm sure. Now, you're known for being an explorer and the first person to reach the South Pole alone. Why did you do that? Was it simply because it was there or because there was another reason?
I think we are all born explorers. When I looked at my kids, when they were small, they wanted to climb before they could walk. They were always wondering what was hidden behind the entrance door. And I've somehow kept that spirit. And as I said, I ended up walking alone to the South Pole for 50 days and nights in the midnight sun. And that expedition learned me a great lesson on silence. So somehow, the quieter I became on that expedition, the more I heard. And I also got convinced that our brain can be wider than the sky.
Well, but that had to be on some level a scary thing to do, in that you could have fallen, broken a leg, gone through the ice, eaten by some kind of South Pole animal.
Yeah, but you know, if it hadn't been very difficult walking to the South Pole, everybody could do it. And of course, I was in for a challenge. I wanted to make this world record about being the first to walk there alone, just like I also climbed Everest and walked to the North Pole. So in one way, this was, you know, also about competition. But it was also very much about exploring myself and try to understand silence, and not only silence on expeditions, but I think, you know, about silence in my and everybody else's daily life.
Excuse me, and I'm going to have to break the silence here a little bit because I've got some commercials I've got to run. But you're going to stay with me, Mr. Kagi, as we when we come back, we'll talk about his new book, Silence in the Age of Noise. And I'm back. It's WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest, Erling Kagi, his new book, Silence in the Age of Noise. Tell me about the book, Erling.
Yeah, I have three teenage daughters, and I have been doing these expeditions to remote areas on Earth, and I have a busy life as in my office as a publisher, and my life in recent years has been very much about noise, and I ask myself, what is silence, where is it, and why is it more important today than ever before? And I eventually came down with 33 answers. And because when I looked at my daughters, I understood that silence is almost extinct today. And we definitely live in the age of noise. And I could tell that my daughters and also me, quite often, the present hurt. And I was living through my device. I was Googling something and found what I was searching for. And 20 minutes later, I was still Googling. And then I figured out that noise is good sometimes. Technology is also a positive thing, but it has gone too far. That we also need the silence in addition to the noise. And I'm thinking about silence, not only the silence that is surrounding us, but also this inner silence, this silence which is there all the time. And it's very enriching because life is long if we listen to ourselves often enough and sometimes look up from our phones.
I would imagine, though, the noise in your head, how do you turn that off?
Pardon me?
How do you deal with the noise in your head? Because I've been...
You know, that's a very good question because I think for me too, when I'm searching for silence, I get into the woods and it's absolutely quiet around me, but I still have noise in my head, as you said. And That is because I'm quite often I'm thinking too much, probably like you. And when you're thinking about the future or the past, and that could be kind of noise. So, but as if you manage to, you know, avoid quitting for a few minutes or maybe half an hour, I think, you know, eventually it will calm down between your ears and you will have some inner silence.
Is inner silence as you experienced it true silence and nothing's in there?
Yeah, it is like shutting out the world and kind of emptying, you know, your mind a little bit. Not in sense of doing yoga or mindfulness or meditation, which, you know, use techniques, but just kind of relax and not looking at your phone all the time. And when I'm thinking about silence, a search for silence, I'm not thinking about turning you back to the world and living a more egocentric life. I think about the opposite. It's about opening up, see people, you know, from a different angle, and love the earth even more.
What'd your daughters think about all of this?
The two oldest ones, you know, they start to get it. They read my book. They start to see that they're kind of wasting the time by always being connected, always living through other people, always being distracted. And they very much like my book, and the friends like my book. But my youngest daughter, who's now 16, she still, you know, she doubts my message. She still loves her phone. She still finds the present to be very difficult. And she thinks about silence as being lonely, bored, sad, not having anything to do. And of course, that's silence too. But my point, as her sister, I started to understand, silence is also so much more.
Well, it seems to me, though, people who don't like silence are people who don't like their own company.
Hey, I think that's a very, very valid point. It's it's not only about not liking, it's about finding it difficult, your own company. And I think that's something women and men have been struggling with for ages, for hundreds of years, maybe forever, that to be alone in a room doing nothing is very difficult. And instead of doing nothing, you start doing something. And that's quite often the beginning of all your problems. And this has been written about throughout, you know, the centuries. But today it's so much more noise. It's so many more options. It's so many more distractions. So, and then we're going for noise. And of course, noise is always the easiest alternative compared to silence, because noise doesn't demand anything of us, while silence, as I said, you know, sometimes it's a bit complicated to reach. I don't think it's difficult, but it's a little bit complicated. But I find silence throughout the day, when I get up in the morning, when I'm making breakfast for my kids, sometimes when I walk to the metro, when I walk the stairs in my office, I find silence when I'm having a shower. And I find silence when I do the dishes, because, of course, then nobody will disturb me. And sometimes I find silence when I go to bed.
Did you always like your own company?
I think, you know, for me too, sometimes I find my own company a bit difficult. I'm restless. I would like to do something. Then you have to, you know, cool down a little bit and try to listen to yourself, because I think if you always live through other people, you know, it seems like life is moving very fast, that life is short, and that's not right. You know, you have sufficient of time. That life is long if you know how to use it.
Well, how do you use silence? Is it simply to recharge your batteries? Or do you do something else with it?
It is to recharge my batteries for sure, but it's also about getting to know myself, because, as I said, silence is about other people. It's about technology, while silence is very much about yourself, this inner silence. So your silence will be different from my silence, because it is, you know, partly also about exploring yourself, getting to know yourself, and it's about understanding that silence in itself is rich, that it is a quality, something exclusive and luxurious, and even a key to unlock new ways of thinking.
That implies, though, again, I go back to some people like their own inner self and some people don't. What do you say to people who aren't sure whether they like themselves or not?
I think, you know, many people, my experience is that many people underestimate their own possibilities in life. I've been traveling a lot in Europe and in the States and also in Asia and Africa. And, of course, sometimes you get the impression if you're looking, you know, follow the media, that most people overestimate themselves. But I think in general, I think we are underestimating the possibilities we have in life. And I also think that's why it's so easy to choose noise throughout the day than having, you know, a break every now and then and search for your own silence. Because I think somehow wandering is the very engine of life.
How did you learn to turn off all the inner stuff, though? Those inner the inner noise, the inner thinking, the inner person, the inner Erlang, who is not necessarily the most positive Erlang.
Yeah, it's that's, you know, I think I haven't really learned it yet, in the sense that I sometimes find, you know, silence that could be very uncomfortable. It could even be sometimes a little bit frightening. And that's still, I'm 56 years today, and I'm just 56 years old. And I still think sometimes it's, you know, difficult to dig into my own silence, because in that room, I'm going to get to know myself better. And that's not always nice. So I think, you know, but I don't think life should be nice all the time. I think, you know, sometimes life should be a little bit complicated. And my experience is that the reason, you know, we have more and more depressed people, restless people, aggressive people on Earth today is that we have lost contact with nature and we lost contact with ourselves. And although all this telephones and computers and apps are being made according to these big corporations to make people cooperate better, to make new societies, to make less lonely people, I think the opposite is happening.
Now, going back to your exploring, you accomplished a rather amazing feat. Walked the South Pole, walked the North Pole, and climbed Mount Everest? That's amazing to me.
Thank you.
You ever going to stop?
I never felt I started doing expeditions. As I said earlier on, I think we're all born explorers. So something I just, you know, kept on doing since my childhood, tried to explore the world and explore myself. But these long expeditions, as you mentioned, I don't think I will go on to climb Everest a second time, because today I have an interesting job and I have responsible for three daughters. So, you know, it's a season of everything. So today I find great satisfaction by writing about things I find deeply important and also things I find being a bit under-communicated in our society. So that's also kind of exploration to me. So, I'm very happy with what I'm doing today.
Now, in addition to being a writer and an explorer, you're also a publisher, correct?
Yeah.
Does being a publisher make it easier or harder to write your own book? Because certainly you can publish anything you want, but did it make it harder to have an ideal to live up to?
In one way, it makes it a little bit harder in the sense that I put more expectations on myself, but this book, Silence in the Age of Noise, is now translated to 37 languages, so I have 37 publishers in addition to myself. And so Unfortunately, I didn't have to publish the book myself because nobody else wanted to publish it. But of course, being a publisher and publish yourself in your own language, you know, then you also, you know, it's a little bit risky. But I felt that this theme about silence was something also Norwegians would be very interested to read. And fortunately, they are.
What do you want people to get from the book when they've read it?
I think, you know, I wanted to write in, you know, a short book on silence. I didn't want people to spend many evenings reading about what I thought about silence. But my hope is that people will, every now and then, maybe a few times during the day, shut out the world and get to know themselves better and to enrich their lives and, you know, somehow learn from Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple. Although, you know, he made all these smartphones, he was totally clear to his own family, don't use those devices too much, but limit it to a few hours every day.
Good advice, certainly. You going to be writing any more books?
I think so. I'm just about having, you know, finishing a book on walking, which I think is, you know, one way it's also about silence, but it's about a bit more concrete about silence. But I think a good thing with walking is that then you let your mind wander, and you manage to relax in your head, and you get closer to the elements, and you get to do some thinking. So to me, walking is also very much about silence. So my next book will be Walking, One Step at a Time.
Whether it's in your writing or in your silence or in your exploring, were you ever just plain scared?
If I ever play?
Were you ever just scared?
Scared? You know, on an expedition, you're always a little bit scared in the sense that it is dangerous. But if you get too scared, you stop being rational, and then you start doing stupid things. So it's two things I think you have to avoid on an expedition. It's about getting too scared and too self-confident. But you should always be a little bit worried, that's for sure. Because if not, you will fail. So I see all those people who are too confident on expeditions, they're quite often, you know, not succeeding.
And I'd like to say, do you have a website, Erling?
I'm not that civilized yet, unfortunately, but my book will be in all bookstores and also at Amazon. So I think, you know, I say in my books what I want to say, and somehow I'm a bit behind in terms of having a website.
Okay. What's left to explore?
I think, you know, most things remain to explore in the sense that the world is a little bit new every day. As you can, you know, tell if you walk, you can see it changes a little bit every day. And also, although someone has been ahead of you, that you will see everything with your own eyes and experience everything in a slightly different way than everybody else. So in that sense, I think, you know, the world, the whole world, remains to be explored. So I'm quite often asked if it's any more things to do, is there any more challenges worth working for or fighting for, struggling for, and then I always think and try to say and explain that you have to find your own self poles.
Interesting, to say the least. And I'd like to say thank you to Erling Kagi, his new book, Silence. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Peter.
My pleasure. And it's been another edition of WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. Don't forget my email address if you want to be in touch. Let me know what you're thinking, what you like, what you don't like. Somebody you think I need to talk to, some book I need to know about. It's peter.solomon solomon, at hotmail.com. peter.solomon@hotmail.com. Stay tuned for Sports Talk with Sonny Hill. Always interesting and provocative discussion in the living room. Your opinions, Sonny's reactions. I know I'll be listening. And I want to say thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer. Some days it gets a little hairy around here when guests aren't where they're supposed to be. So for that, I do apologize, but I'm not quite sure what I can do about it. Now, Phil makes it work anyway. So thank you, Phil. And to Ann Tadman-Solomon, my dear wife, support system, and the associate producer. Couldn't do it without you either. So thank you, Ann. Stay tuned for Sonny Hill. Always provocative discussion in the living room. I'll be listening. Finally, here's my favorite. Well, finally, there's nothing left to say, but February's around the corner. Hopefully the weather is going to get warmer. See you soon.